Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is Podcast 9. I'm your host, Dominic Robbie, and with me today are...
Ben Snitkoff.
And David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, we're going to be talking about the Associated Press and their crackdown on unpaid use of articles online. Then we'll talk about Palm Pre and iTunes as the arms race between Apple and Palm escalates, as Palm attempts to make its smartphone look like an iPod and Apple attempts to fight back. And finally, we'll talk about Lawyer's Brief appearing on LexisNexis and Westlaw. So let's get right into our first story. The Associated Press has published its new copy protection scheme, where it details how it wants to wrap stories in a digital wrapper that will provide identifying information so that any citations to that article will link back to the Associated Press and or to the newspaper that is the primary source, instead of having search engines link to second-hand or third-hand sources that just copy and paste the AP article. What do you guys think about this story? What's interesting about it?
I think the most interesting thing about this is that the AP seems to be trying to implement word-for-word Judge Posner's note that he made on his blog a couple of weeks ago now.
Well, I might disagree with that a little bit. I don't know, because Judge Posner was actually suggesting that we expand copyright law to give further protection to these types of entities. And I think what they're really doing is they're providing themselves with a technological means of finding out who exactly is using their articles so they can go after them. And what's interesting to me about it is that, as far as I've read about the digital wrapper, it's not actually going to prevent anybody from using their stories, but instead it's just going to kind of provide identity information about who is linking to the stories and who's using the stories in any part.
The quote that I thought was interesting from the article was that if someone can build a multi-billion dollar business out of keywords, we can build a multi-hundred million dollar business out of headlines. And that's Mr. Curley, the president of the Associated Press. Basically, the company's position is that they want even a tiny use of a news article is going to require a licensing agreement with the organization that produced that article.
Right.
That includes links.
So what I understand is what I understand is that they do want to either prohibit or license the use of both links and headlines, which I mean, I agree that Judge Posner did want to extend the scope of copyright law, but this is essentially expanding the scope. It's not expanding the scope. It's expanding how they want to use copyright law to protect their content in line with Judge Posner's suggestion as to how to save the newspaper industry.
Right. And I think what's interesting, though, is the comment that they're really seeking to kind of expand what they know about who's using their articles and how they want everybody to pay for almost any use. And they're really suggesting that headlines, number one, are, you know, might possibly fall under copyrightable subject matter, which I think is kind of questionable, depending on how a headline is actually phrased. I mean, if you have a headline that really is only 2, 3, maybe 5 words in the end of the day, it might not even qualify for original expression, especially if it's using facts. If it says that, you know, Google's website went down today, that's really a factual phrase right there. It's not even a sentence, and I don't think it would qualify for expression. And the second part of it that sort of bothers me is the fact that fair use protects a lot of uses. As long as they're not totally taking from the original article, you can quote a few sentences, a paragraph even, out of an AP article for your own criticism or commentary purposes, and you're not liable for copyright infringement. And it seems that the AP wants to totally restrict that right, and that does bother me a bit.
There's actually an interesting debate that goes on relation to fair use law, which is, if there is a licensing scheme available, is that essentially a fifth factor in the fair use analysis? You know, if it's easily licensed, should that be considered as to whether or not it was fair use? And this may be something that AP is trying to set up. They're saying, you know, we can license this. We're setting up a scheme for easy licensing. And that should be, at the very least, it should consider, you know, what the effect is on the market of this fair use, if not, you know, be an extra factor in and of itself.
To take a step back, fair use in the law is encoded in Section 107 of the Copyright Act, and there's four factors that courts consider in determining whether a particular use is or is not fair. The first factor is the purpose and character of the use, which basically is how that copyrighted material was used, if it's commercial use or if it's in a nonprofit educational purpose. The second is the nature of the copyrighted work, in other words, what is actually being used. Here it would be just headlines or potentially links to the articles. The third would be the amount and substantiality of the use in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole, which is basically saying, all right, if you're reproducing the entirety of the copyrighted work, or are you just taking a little bit and then pointing at it? And here, for example, for headlines, well, it's the entire headline generally, but the headline itself tends to be a very small part of the article. And finally, the effect of the use upon the potential market for or the value of copyrighted work. Let's talk about that fourth factor. Is there really a market for news headlines just as headlines?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you think about how people read, well, this is how I read a traditional printed newspaper. I tend to scan headlines myself, and when the headlines grab my attention, I might skim the article really quick or give it a full read. But there seems to be some sort of inherent value in the headline itself, because it's worthy of grabbing your attention almost. And I think how that plays out, it plays out similarly on some of the news aggregator sites like Google News. Google News will often give you headlines and maybe a short clip of the story, but not the full story, and that seems to drive your attention into the article as you click through. And in these circumstances, I guess what the AP is really saying is that other people who are potentially not authorized to reproduce their stories are either using their headlines or their headlines and their articles in whole or in part, and you know, therefore, that they should have some sort of protection that applies to use of those headlines.
You just made a great argument as to why headlines themselves are expressive works and not facts.
If I will concede that partially, but I think it's questionable, and you can't say wholeheartedly that headlines are definitely copyrightable. I think that it applies very much on a case-by-case basis. And like I said, if you have a short headline that it only consists of a few words or a short phrase, and it's very factual, it's probably not going to be covered under the Copyright Act as copyrightable subject matter.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on any particular point there, except to say that the number of words isn't as important as the choice of words. You could have a very short headline that's very expressive. And the expressive content of the headline is what draws you in. I mean, it could just be a very factual statement that's at the same time very engaging, but good headlines are going, there's going to be some expression of the news in there, at least in my opinion. And I agree, it's a you know, case-by-case, headline-by-headline analysis, but it would be very difficult for you to go in and say that, you know, no headline is copyrightable.
Right, I agree.
So let's talk about the technology that they propose to use. It's unclear exactly how this digital wrapper is going to work, but from what I understand, it looks like it's just going to be sort of an XML format that publishers are going to agree to use, and then it's going to serve as a container. There seems like a really big loophole to this, which is, I think one of you pointed this out in our email discussion prior to the podcast, and that's copy-paste. Browsers are still going to be displaying text, and people are still going to be able to select text and just copy it out, and an unscrupulous news organization can just copy-paste out the information without worrying about the digital wrapper.
Possibly. I mean, it really comes down to how they're going to actually implement this. You know, what they could do is, you know, put the actual articles into some sort of format where you can't copy-paste, and you know, probably to do that, they'd have to come up with some type of plugin that you would need to even view the articles. You know, what comes to mind is similar to how some companies opt to use Flash, because Flash isn't easily copyable. And so that might be one way that they do it. And I guess it really comes down to how they actually come about doing this in the end.
Ben, any thoughts on it?
I agree with what David said. The other thing they can do is images, but even if they have images, somebody's going to make a fairly easy hack, which is going to find the AP article, take a screen snap of it, and then do optical character recognition and immediately translate it into text. You know, no matter how much they put up here, this information, it's news. It's going to get out. I don't know what they hope to gain.
Here's the other thing, too, is that it doesn't stop somebody from actually who does have you know, access to an article. It doesn't stop them from just typing it back out word for word onto a new into a new format somewhere, and they can post it wherever they like. You know, the protection that if the AP did it in this particular way, the protection it would give them would only be against copy pasting. And I think you made a great point too, is that, you know, where companies try to protect things using, you know, DRM type techniques, someone always comes out and, you know, finds a way to defeat the DRM.
DRM being digital rights management software, which basically tries to control what users can and can't do with the data. It's interesting in the discussions or the articles that have covered this topic, the Associated Press has declined to consider the fair use question in terms of whether they feel that headlines would be fair use or whether the licenses, how the licenses would play in with that. So it's unclear whether they, I mean, they definitely thought about it, but it's unclear what their position will be in terms of what fair use would be. I'm not entirely clear how they plan to make money off of this, apart from selling people the rights to use headlines. And I was reading, I unfortunately don't remember the source, someone made the important or the intelligent point that, Google News uses, for example, many algorithms that were developed at significant cost and developer time in order to create. And the newspapers could have built Google News themselves had they wanted to.
Well, first, just to hit your first point about the fair use, I think that they have considered the fair use thing, and it scares them because they don't want to challenge fair use. If someone were to assert a fair use defense, they don't want to challenge it because they're afraid of an adverse ruling in a court. And once an adverse precedent starts to sort of snowball, you know, it happens in one jurisdiction and other jurisdictions start to follow it, all of a sudden the AP is left with not as many remedies as they once thought they might have had against people using portions of their articles. And the second part is, as I understood some of the, I read a couple articles on this actually, and as I understood it, the AP is actually seeking to disinclude their articles from use in certain search engines as well. So I read that to mean that they would like it so that Google News, for instance, wouldn't use any of the AP stories at all, and with, you know, without a, some sort of licensing agreement in place. So it would effectively force companies who want to use AP stories, and let's not forget, AP stories are everywhere. Everybody uses AP stories these days. It seems like you can't go onto a news website without stumbling across an AP news story in the first 5 minutes that you're on the site. And everybody wants to use these things, and if they are able to effectively disinclude it from all of the search engines and aggregator websites, you know, it will probably force people to opt into either some sort of licensing scheme or not use the articles at all. So I think that's how they're kind of seeking to monetize it in that way. Mm.
There was a second part. So Dave tackled the fair use. What was the second part of your question a minute ago, Dominic?
The second part was these whole search engines and news aggregators are basically new technology that people have created and invented using innovative prowess to create a new way of accessing the news. I mean, 15 years ago, you didn't have news aggregators online. You just sort of had Yahoo and the main newspaper sites, and there was really no way to get everything in one place. There wasn't anything like Google News, where Google has created something and made something new. Nothing has really prevented the newspapers themselves from having created an open news portal like that or having linked to articles themselves. Google just did it first and did it better than what the newspapers have tried to do. And I guess it's sort of a free market competition argument in that if they want to create their own news aggregator, they're free to do so instead of trying to hobble Google's news aggregator by introducing all sorts of technological protections. I'm not necessarily agreeing with their argument, I'm just advancing it.
Right. I mean, you have to question the wisdom of this move on the part of AP, if only because no one has ever made money on the web by encouraging people not to visit their website, which seems to be, when you boil it down, what the AP strategy is. You know, we're going to make it harder for people to get AP news. It's a question mark, question mark, question mark, profit.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I mean, let's not forget, though. So, like I said before, everybody uses AP articles to some extent. I've seen them on almost all of the major, you know, news sites like CNN and Fox and MSNBC and et cetera. But the AP, you know, does have copyright protection that applies to their original expression that they crank out. So all of the AP news stories, I mean, the AP does have a right to seek royalties from its use. And if we look at the way that the internet is today, you know, it's totally the case that this type of expression is easily copyable, and you can copy, paste it, retype it, whatever. You could put it wherever you want. And so I almost don't blame the AP for wanting to find a way they can crack down on the use by unauthorized individuals of their work. I do sort of question, though, you know, the extent to which they want to crack down on it and the extent to which they want to sort of limit fair use as it exists.
Makes sense. All right. That's pretty much all there is to cover on that topic, nor all that we have time to cover on that topic. I'm sure we could talk for hours, but I'm not sure how many listeners would stay with us. So let's move on to the next topic, which is the Palm Pre and iTunes arms race. Basically, the essence of this story is Palm, when they released their new phone, the Palm Pre, they made it look like an iPod to iTunes, which is Apple's music software. Apple noticed this and said future versions of iTunes may not be compatible with third-party devices, and lo and behold, iTunes 8.2.1 made Palm Pre devices no longer work. But Palm then pushed an update to their phone's OS, which re-enabled what they call Palm Media Sync, which basically makes the Palm Pre look like an Apple device to iTunes, and once again, Palm can sync its music with iTunes. So there's actually a pretty interesting technological story and legal perspective here. Is that right, Ben?
That's true. So to give you an idea of how Palm did this briefly, in the first revision of the first version of the Palm Web OS, when you switch the Palm Pre into media mode, it would change its product ID, which is a little, it's a few bytes long. I'm trying to figure this out in my head real quick. How many hex things that is? It's one, anyway, it's a little code that the device sends to the computer, and it's the product ID. So each USB product is given a unique product ID. And that basically tricked the computer into thinking that it was an iPod and iTunes would automatically sync with it. What it didn't change is what's called the vendor ID, which is a unique serial number that's assigned to each person who has a license to make USB devices. What Palm did with this next revision is they changed not just when you flip the Palm Pre into vendor mode, iPod mode, media sync mode. It changes both the product ID to make it look like an iPod and the vendor ID to make it look like it's from Apple.
So in other words, Palm is pretending that the Palm Pre, when it's switched into media mode, is actually made by Apple according to the USB protocol and the USB vendor ID, which is, I guess, you apply for if you're a manufacturer?
Yes, that is true on both points.
Can they do that?
Not according to the agreement they agreed to when they signed up to be a USB vendor.
And what does that agreement say? That you have to, your vendor ID has to stay?
So, yeah, let's see. Each vendor ID number is assigned to one company for its sole and exclusive use along with associated product identification numbers. They may not be sold, transferred, or used by others directly or indirectly, except in special circumstances, and then only upon written approval by the USB USB IF. The IF is the implementers forum, what Palm would have signed up for.
And so what can Apple do in retaliation, I guess?
So Apple can do what Palm has already done. Palm has already filed a complaint with the USB implementers forum saying that Apple is misusing the vendor ID by preventing Palm from syncing with Apple's iTunes. Apple is almost definitely going to also file a complaint saying that Palm is misusing its vendor ID by pretending that its Palm device is made by Apple without having sought previous written approval from the USB implementers forum.
So I thought this was pretty funny because Palm goes ahead basically, and it's like a preemptive strike, and because they know that, you know, Apple clearly doesn't want the Palm Pre device to sync to iTunes. And so what they went ahead and did is they file a complaint with the USB group, and they say, hey, Apple is actually misusing this because they're excluding, you know, USB devices from connecting and syncing with iTunes. I mean, there's something kind of funny about that, you have to admit.
Yeah, what I like about what Palm did here is that they did it the first way, where they didn't have to change the vendor ID. So they were still violating it by misusing the product ID, arguably at least. And they kind of let Apple say, they kind of put the ball in Apple's court saying, so are you going to lock us out based on our vendor ID too? And Apple went and changed iTunes and locked them out based on the vendor ID, which in turn Palm revised their software so it would pretend to be an Apple product and still sync. It's interesting that they kind of did that when they very easily could have just changed the vendor ID to begin with.
What is the purpose, though, of the vendor ID in the end of the day? Can either of you answer that?
To identify the person who the company that manufactured that particular device.
Right.
So isn't it foreseeable then that Apple could be using vendor IDs for this purpose, only to allow, you know, Apple-manufactured hardware to be able to sync with iTunes?
That seems like that's precisely the point of the vendor ID.
Right, right. So, I mean, I'm just not seeing too many ways, if Apple is going to contest this, that Palm is going to be able to get out of it. you know, they could try to claim that, you know, Apple is being anti-competitive by not letting other devices sync, but if that's like the sole purpose of having this vendor ID, I just don't see them getting around it.
Well, is Apple being anti-competitive by not allowing other devices to sync to iTunes?
Well, I mean, by what standard are we defining anti-competitive? From an antitrust standpoint, from, you know, a general fairness standpoint, from what here?
Let's try the general fairness standpoint first.
Yeah, probably.
And the antitrust perspective?
Probably not.
Why?
Well, I don't know. You know what? I don't know because this is Apple software, and they sort of they've put all of their resources and their R&D behind developing a, you know, software platform that, you know, syncs well with Apple devices and devices, at least devices that they intended to be able to sync with. And to me, that tells me that Apple should have some sort of right to control what devices actually are able to sync with iTunes.
I mean, it is their software. You can run the competition argument that Apple could spend the time and development money or developer time hours to build their own iTunes or iTunes lookalike that would sync with the Palm Pre. But they didn't. They're trying to piggyback off of Apple's iTunes, which is already at version 8.2.1, so there's a lot of iterations there.
I mean, why should Palm be given the right to basically use all of the resources that Apple has put into this?
That's a question that I don't think Palm has a good answer for, apart from the fact that iTunes is the best or the market leader.
Ben, what do you think?
It's not an easy question to answer. I wish I had a nice, clear answer for this, but if you can look at it two ways. One, you know, Palm is not misappropriating any of Apple's work. They've done all of the hard work on their end to make sure that the Palm Pre works just like an iPod and accepts all of the sync commands just like an iPod would. So, I mean, it's not like... let me back up a second. So, it's not like Apple is, you know, burdened by this. It's Palm has done all of the hard work on their end.
Well, they're not immediately burdened by this, but what happens then when Palm Pre customers start calling up Apple and saying, hey, I'm having trouble with my device, you know, assuming that the Palms are able to sync with the iTunes, and Apple hasn't done anything. You know what? Apple's now in the position where they might be fielding phone calls from Palm Pre owners saying, "Hey, I'm having trouble syncing my device with your software." And you know, from the get-go, it's pretty much the case that Apple never intended any other devices to be synced with it. So now they do have a little bit of burden on Palm Pre customers.
So
and it might even continue if, you know, they don't take any action to exclude the Palm Pre from being able to sync with it.
To start out with, iTunes has a fairly extensive list of third-party music players that it works with. You can find that somewhere on the Apple website. I'll find it and put it in the show notes. Those are mostly legacy, though, from when iTunes was SoundJam back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But more to the point, Apple has made it very clear that they don't support these non-supported players. And Apple has, in the past, when people call up, you know, with Hackintoshes that they're having trouble installing OS X on, Apple will just say, "Yeah, well, we're not going to support you because it's not a supported, you know, it's not you're not installing OS X on a supported computer." If somebody called up Apple and said, "Yeah, I can't get my Palm Pre to sync with iTunes," Apple is going to look at them and say, "You're not using a supported music player. Go call Palm."
Okay, let me just take that a step ahead then. What happens when a Palm Pre then somehow damages the iTunes software on someone's computer? You know, what does Apple have to do then?
Apple's...
How could it?
Well, they've got a problem. You know, they're worried about their own image, and they don't want to see other devices coming in and causing problems to their software. They don't want to have any interference from other parties.
I'm not sure how much I buy that argument. If I install a third-party program on my computer that crashes my operating system, I'm not going to call up Apple and... I mean, so I may very well call up Apple and complain, but Apple's going to say, you know, you installed a third-party application. There's nothing we can do about that. You know, that's out of
our... That's one of the things that Apple has always done, though. I mean, from as far back as I can remember, Apple has always been pretty restrictive about the types of hardware that they allow to, you know, be used on any of their Apple devices, including computers, and, you know, they are almost control freaks. You know, they only allow very specific hardware in their machines. And as far as that extends to Apple software on, say, non-Apple computers, I can only assume that, you know, their interest in making sure that everything works perfectly in sort of the Apple's perfect world of hardware devices and software, that they do have an interest in making sure that other things aren't screwing around with, you know, what they've taken the time to create.
There's a huge difference, though, between hardware that's in the computer and peripheral hardware. There's a huge range of peripheral hardware that works with the Apple. It's not like I can only use an Apple-branded headset or an Apple-branded external hard drive or an Apple-branded monitor on my computer. You know, all three of those that I'm using right now have been bought by from third parties. Your argument
hardware,
just not...
yes, but you also have the software that's, you know, responsible for the syncing in between. I mean, there is still a little bit of software in the Palm Pre that is, you know, attempting to sync with iTunes.
Returning to the USB vendor ID thing, Palm, with the release of its 1.1 OS update, actually made a statement that said that they feel that what Apple's doing with the vendor ID number is inappropriate. At the same time, though, they're kind of making their vendor ID number pretend to be Apple's, which violates what they agreed to with the USB IF, or the USB implementers forum. I believe that violates it. So what consequences could Palm face? Like, it seems to me, from what I understand, the worst that could happen is that they will lose the USB compatible sticker they get to put on their boxes, which doesn't seem particularly painful in terms of a loss.
Well, if you take this form that you're required to sign and fill out as a USB device manufacturer, and if you take that to be an enforceable contract, and if you go a step further and take the language that they've included on here that says that you're not going to, you know, use a vendor ID unless it's in certain special circumstances with written approval, you know, you could take that to mean that when Palm Pre started spoofing the vendor ID numbers, it's basically a breach of the contract, and in that case, Palm Pre could be liable for damages.
The question, though, is to whom would they be liable? Would they just be liable to the USB implementers forum, or could Apple say that, you know, we're a third-party beneficiary of this? You know, Palm agreed to these rules mutually so that all of us would get along and not make hardware that interferes with other people's hardware or other people's software. So could Apple... I think the big question here is, could Apple theoretically bring a claim against Palm for a breach of the contract?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, there are like a bunch of procedural ways you could do that in a very complicated manner. I mean, if Apple happened to sue Palm Pre and then also join the USBIF as a interested party to the action, I mean, that's probably one way they could do it.
I was thinking more directly about whether or not Apple could be a non-named third-party beneficiary in this contract.
I think that's a good read, too. I think that's just another way to attach another bit of liability to this whole issue, and I think that's totally possible.
Yeah, so to delegalify that a second, a third-party beneficiary to a contract is, let's say I have a contract between me and David, and the contract says something along the lines of, I will give David $500 to paint my house, and David will also paint Dominic's house while he's at it. Dominic, who isn't an actual party to the contract because he's not making promises on either side, is a named third-party beneficiary because he benefits from that contract despite the fact that he's not a party to that contract. He didn't sign any piece of paper there.
That makes sense. And I guess in this case, Apple would be the third-party beneficiary, and they wouldn't be party, but they would... So what sort of remedies would they be able to seek?
That's a tough question.
Anything that falls under contract law, I mean, that could go anywhere from, you know, a preliminary injunction to full enjoyment of Palm being able to use the vendor ID, and additionally damages for the breach, as you know, the breach to an intended third party beneficiary.
Okay.
So we're talking expectation yes. Damages, incidental, consequential damages, all of those things.
I was going to go with what would they be likely to receive. Dave picked the better answer to that question, which is, what possibly could they get? Yeah. As for what they're likely to receive, I'm going to maintain that that's a tough question. There's very little in the contract about, you know, what damages will be available and what damages won't be available. So, and I mean, especially when you're dealing with Apple's, I'm going to say questionable claim as to whether or not they're a third-party beneficiary. It's a really tough call as to, you know, what Apple would be able to get against Palm using this contract as a cause of action.
All right. We'll continue to watch this story as the Palm and Apple battle over iTunes and the Palm Pre continues, and we'll keep you updated with any interesting legal and technical updates in this story. And now we're going to turn to our final story, which is the Lexis Westlaw attorney brief story. So Lexis and Westlaw, for those of you who don't know, are basically sort of Google's for legal cases, except for their interfaces are a bit more complicated because they allow people to search precedent and law cases. And Lexis and Westlaw both are pretty expensive subscription services that generally law firms subscribe to or lawyers subscribe to individually. They run quite expensive, and they sell an interesting package of other services in addition to just accessing case law. Among these services, recently they've started uploading briefs that attorneys have used in cases, scanning them using optical character recognition, OCR technology, and then putting it online so that people who are doing similar research will be able to see what other attorneys have written on this case. These briefs tend to be available on something called PACER, which is the government's pay service for accessing court records and documents. For example, if Ben sues Dave, they both have to prepare briefs in court, and they submit these briefs to the judge, who will then read them. And the briefs are also put on PACER. Lexis and Westlaw then get these briefs off of PACER, scan them using OCR, and put them up on Lexis and Westlaw, where they're accessible to attorneys who subscribe via search results. The reason this story comes up is a lawyer has basically said that, well, the lawyers who write these briefs retain copyright in these briefs because they have generally spent hundreds of hours working on these briefs, preparing legal research, fine-tuning their prose, trying to focus their argument. And while the briefs are specific to the case that they're for, the general legal principles that are often summarized and presented in these briefs tend to be applicable for that entire area of law. So it's very possible for, say, a lazy or efficient, depending which word you want to use, lawyer to look at briefs that other lawyers have written and crib from them, so to speak, and just say, ah, well, these guys have already done all the hard research, so I'm just going to base what they've done and maybe rework their words a couple bits so it's not the exact same thing, so I'm not plagiarizing, but they can sort of free ride off what they're doing. And Lexis and Westlaw didn't ask the permissions of the people who wrote the briefs originally in order to post them on their site. So that's sort of the essence of what's going on. Do you guys have any thoughts on this or anything else that you want to add?
Well, the fact that Lexis and Westlaw are uploading these briefs is actually a very beneficial thing in the end of the day. So if Lexis and Westlaw were just publishing the absolute opinions that came down from cases, it doesn't really elucidate what the arguments might have been in the case. You only know what so far what has been published in the opinion itself. If you have if you have access or the ability to go back and check the briefs, all the briefs that were submitted by attorneys on both sides, you know exactly what was argued, how it was argued, and what the ultimate outcome was before a particular judge. So there is a lot of benefit to being able to read these types of briefs.
Okay, I mean, I agree that there's a lot of benefit, but that doesn't really go to the ultimate question as to whether or not it's copyright infringement.
Right. I am sort of the opinion that these briefs almost definitely qualify for copyright protection. As we go back again, as always, to the extent of what is copyrightable, the portions of the briefs that might have included quotations from other opinions in other lawsuits and stuff like that, when the attorneys are actually citing precedent for particular points of law, obviously those things will not qualify as original, so it's not going to be included within the copyright. But any of the original expression that is used by the attorneys in the briefs, that certainly does qualify for copyright protection.
I guess the core question is whether it's fair use for Lexis and Westlaw to copy these briefs. And we've covered fair use earlier in this podcast, the four factors: the purpose and character, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount of substantiality of the portion used, and the effect of use on the potential market or the value of the copyrighted work. Is there a market in attorneys' briefs apart from Lexis and Westlaw services?
I think there is. They're called clients, generally. I'm going to disagree with you, though, as to what the ultimate issue with this is. As for Lexis and Westlaw, I think their much better argument is that attorneys dedicate the works to the public once they submit them to the court. I mean, I don't know how much support there is for that, but I don't think they have a very strong fair use argument. So to touch back on the fair use argument, Westlaw is making commercial use, which weighs against fair use. Westlaw and Lexis are making commercial use of these briefs. They're using the entire work. They're not substantially transforming it because they're keeping the work in the same form. And as for the market, it's hard to say how much of an effect of a market there is, but there certainly is, you know, value to these briefs, and I'm not sure how much that value gets diminished by this use, but you've got three of those factors weighing very heavily against Westlaw and Lexis.
I just want to weigh in on that point that you made, that the attorneys are dedicating this to the public. What do you, I mean, they're filing this in a public, in the court, which is public, but they're not necessarily stripping copyright protection from it by making it public. I mean, if I publish a book and it's public, that doesn't make it not copyrighted.
Right. What I meant to say was, by dedication to the public, the lawyers are agreeing to let their briefs be freely copied once they submit them to the court. The court's going to make copies for all the clerks. Now, states and the federal government can't be liable for copyright infringement because of the law and the
11th. Well, all government works are basically dedicated to the public domain. So
right. I'm sorry. I'm not talking about works made by the government. I'm talking about the government itself being liable for copyright infringement.
Well, here's a twist. I think in certain works for hire to the government, actually, the actual writer of a document would then lose copyright protection on it, absent some other agreement.
Okay. I mean, that's an interesting fact. It doesn't seem to be particularly...
I don't think that really weighs in here, and you know, what bothers me about this is, even if you try to say that in some way the writers of the briefs themselves are losing copyright protection because there's some sort of implied dedication to the public, I think the argument is just as strong that what is actually being implied by the copyright holders, meaning the attorneys who write these things, is just copying for the limited use of this particular lawsuit. I don't know that it necessarily is, you know, that there's some sort of public dedication, that there's even an intent for public dedication to the works. And so, like, I think I side there with Dominic in that, you know, they definitely don't lose, or they most likely do not lose, copyright protection over the works.
Okay. I don't know.
So the attorney who, or what do, don't you know, I guess?
No, you can go.
The attorney who brought this to, or made this story about this, brought this to attention, he wants to, he feels like he wants to file a class action lawsuit for copyright infringement against LexisNexis and Westlaw. What would the class be? I guess attorneys who have their briefs uploaded. Do we want to talk very briefly on what a class action lawsuit is and how it comes into play in the context like this?
Certainly. So a class action lawsuit has what's called a named plaintiff, and that's somebody who has precisely suffered the injury that they're arguing. So in this case, the lawyer would file a class action either on behalf of himself or another lawyer who had submitted a brief to the court, and then Westlaw and or Lexis had uploaded that brief to the website and put it up for access on their website for a commercial fee. The class action then is a procedural way to get all other people who have also suffered that harm to be joined in this one lawsuit without actually having to identify each and every one of those people and individually joining them into the lawsuit. So when you join somebody into a lawsuit, let's say, again, I'm suing Dominic this time. And Dominic...
Oh, good.
Dominic thinks that David should cover his legal costs because David's an insurer of Dominic. Dominic would, what's called implead, he would join David into the lawsuit. So the lawsuit would no longer just be Ben versus Dominic. It would now be Ben versus Impleader. Would that be Ben versus Dominic versus David, or Ben versus... No, it'd be Ben versus Dominic and David, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, so going back to class actions, there are a few requirements for a class action. The named plaintiff has to have actually suffered injury. He has to be able to provide good representation for the class. All members of the class, and this would be the lawyers who have submitted briefs to the court that have then been uploaded by Lexis and Westlaw for commercial purposes, there'd have to be some common question of law or fact. And in classes like this, when they're seeking damages of some kind, there's usually going to have to be some common measure of damages that they could find, which in this case I think there would be. And then I'm missing one. The plaintiffs have to be too numerous to join. And that's a case-by-case determination. So sometimes, you know, 100 plaintiffs may be too numerous to join. Sometimes 100 may not be too numerous to join. It depends on, you know, how far they're spread across the country, how well represented they are by their own council, things like that.
Well, in this case, I think there's almost no question that this is, you know, pretty ripe for a class action, or at least, you know, for a class certification.
Absolutely.
There are just an outstanding number of people out there who have had their briefs published by Lexis and West.
Yeah, I think the best argument, actually, for Lexis and West law would be that damages would be too hard to determine. So because the vast majority of lawyers do not put copyright notices on their briefs and don't register with the Copyright Office, Westlaw statutory damages wouldn't be applicable. You can't get statutory damages unless a copyright registration has been filed at the time of infringement. So the damages for these suits would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis. And if Lexis and Westlaw have one saving grace, it's that it'd be very difficult to determine damages in these cases.
So to dig a little deeper into this story, what turns out, the attorney who brought, he wrote a letter, an open letter, he wrote a letter to the Supreme Court of California, and it turns out that basically the Supreme Court had been handing off appellate briefs that had been filed to Westlaw and Lexis without any notice or without even permission from the attorneys. And he's basically arguing that, well, you can do that, but you should let us know about it, and further, if we don't want you to, you should not pass it on. Instead, the Supreme Court had kind of apparently under the table, well, not under the table, but just quietly without letting anyone know that they were supplying these briefs to Lexis and Westlaw, where the commercial services then would make money off of it, where the attorneys are saying, it's fine if you want to make money off of briefs, but we should make money off of our work too, or we should be able to control our product, because, for example, he wrote 143-page brief that took hundreds of hours to prepare, and then he found it sold. Access to it was being sold by LexisNexis.
Well, here's a really interesting question, I think. Because the briefs are essentially being made on behalf of clients, does this then sort of implicate this as some sort of work for hire, and that the true owner in this might actually be the client itself?
You had best be backing that up with a definition of work for hire in front of you right now that you can read to me.
I don't have one directly in front of me, but I can kind of summarize it. I mean, a work for hire is basically when somebody hires somebody else. Let's say it's some sort of book distributor. They hire, or a publisher. They hire some sort of author then to create a work for them so that the publisher could then distribute it and sell it and so on and so forth. I mean, the argument here is basically you've got a client that comes into your law office and they've got some sort of legal problem and it requires litigation. And as part of that litigation, it also requires filing briefs to the court. And so therefore, you know, sort of the client has then, you know, sort of hired the attorney, and the work possibly might become a work for hire.
Basically, just to butt in and maybe for a little clarification on work for hire. Basically, work for hire is a copyright doctrine that says that if you make something, you have copyright protection. You're the author, and the copyright protection goes to you. The exception is what happens in a work for hire situation. For example, a client hires an attorney, and now the copyright doesn't go to the attorney who's the actual author of the brief, but instead, because it was a work for hire, the copyright instead vests in the client. I'm not sure whether that actually happens in attorney-client briefs, but that's basically the essence of the work-for-hire doctrine.
My impression... I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, David. My impression was that the work-for-hire doctrine only applied when the work-for-hire was part of a collective work. Is that ringing any bells with people? So it's not enough that the client commissions me to make something. The client has to commission me to make something that's part of, like, that's part of a greater work in order for the copyright to accrue in the person who commissioned the work, as opposed to the person who created it.
Possibly. I'd have to go back and check the actual language.
Yeah, I'm Googling it now.
I just have to take your word for it.
The Copyright Act says the work for hire is a work prepared by an employee within the scope of his or her employment. So attorneys aren't employees of clients, so that falls away. Or a work specially ordered or commissioned for use as a contribution to a collective work, as part of a motion picture or other audiovisual work, a translation, or... So if the parties expressly agree in a written instrument that the work shall be considered a work for hire. So Okay, so I think, Ben, you're correct, and David is also correct, in that the first part of the work for hire says that if it's within the scope of employment, it doesn't need to be part of a collective work. However, if it's something specially ordered or commissioned, then it does need to be part of a collective work and needs to also potentially be explicitly signed as a written instrument, that it is going to be a work for hire, so everyone's clear about that. So I guess that would answer that attorney briefs are not work for hire, so we can sort of put that question to rest.
It's a clever argument, though.
It's just something interesting that just popped into my head, because, you know, as just to tie it back into what you were saying before I cut you off, Dominic, I mean, it would go to the question of who actually has the authority to, you know, authorize consent for further use of a copyrighted work. So, you know, in that case, would it be a client that has to authorize for a court to go on and pass that copyrighted work on to other people like Westlaw and Lexis?
Right. I think there's an interesting professional responsibility question there as to whether or not the lawyer can actually assert any rights in the work that he made on behalf of his client. Although I have absolutely no idea where to start on that. And
well,
yeah.
we'll keep an eye on this story and see if anything develops, if the class action lawsuit actually does get filed or if there's some sort of settlement agreement. And we'll let you know if there's anything that changes. And that's all for this week, so thank you for listening. And if you have any suggestions, thoughts, ideas, complaints, or comments about our podcast, please either visit our website at technicallylegal.org or send us an email at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thanks for listening, and I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Have a great day. Take care.